Welcome to the Job Shop Show, where we talk with the owners, suppliers, partners, and customers of custom manufacturers. Listen and learn the secrets of top-performing job shops, the tools, techniques, and backgrounds that have made them successful, all in the quest of raising the bar for custom manufacturing. I'm your host, Jay Jacobs. This episode is sponsored by Paperless Parts, connecting buyers and suppliers of custom manufactured parts. The Paperless platform is a secure, ITAR-compliant, cloud-based manufacturing system for suppliers that reduces the amount of time spent on sales, estimating, quoting, administration, and order processing. It offers seamless integration with the accounting and ERP software tools that shops already use, such as QuickBooks, E2, and JobBoss. Paperless Parts was founded with a mission to make manufacturing more accessible by streamlining the quote-to-cash process. Spend less time quoting and more time selling.
This episode is sponsored by our friends at the NTMA, the National Tooling and Machining Association. The NTMA is an association of privately held, entrepreneurial-based, and family-owned businesses representing nearly 1,200 small to mid-sized machine shops and tool and die shops across the country. They have approximately 30 very active regional chapters that host local events, run apprenticeship programs, and provide other services to their regional members. As an association of peers, the goal of the NTMA is to help members of the U.S. precision custom manufacturing industry achieve profitable growth and business success in a global economy through networking, workforce development and training, technology, best practices education, advocacy, programs, and services with industry partners. To learn how your company can get involved with the NTMA, including how to join, visit ntma.org.
Shazam! This is Jay Jacobs. Welcome to the Job Shop Show. This may be the most important episode we have put out yet. It is about money and how to maximize what you do with it, while at the same time protecting the downside, not losing money. You work hard as a shop owner or as a team member in the shop, and some of that reward is money. Much is used to pay our living expenses. Some is then available to save, to invest. Investing is hard, and there is a lot of bad, one-sided, and even deceptive information out there. Our guest today, Justin Donald, is the creator of The Lifestyle Investor. He's going to share his story on how to rethink everything you've been taught about investing. It isn't just theory. Justin did it himself first, going from working his way through college to having an eight-figure net worth before the age of 40. And he personally helped me put my money to work with incredible success after I sold Rapid, without putting it in the stock market with its wild gyrations or betting on Bitcoin or other risky cryptocurrencies. Sound too good to be true? Let's talk with Justin and get into how you can become a smarter investor. Welcome to the Job Shop Show, Justin.
Thanks, Jay. I'm so excited to be here and hang out with you and just talk shop, talk business. We have so much fun doing that.
Yeah. Today is a different topic for our audience. And I think it is as important, if not more important, than almost any topic we talk about, because ultimately the goal is to make money to provide for our families and hopefully be able to retire at some point and enjoy what we've done. And if we don't do that correctly, then you've put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears as a shop owner, and you don't necessarily walk away with anything. So you are an expert at this. I'm just so excited to have you on so that you can share some of these things with the audience. And I just want to say to the listeners that Justin is my friend. He's my financial and sometimes life coach and mentor, and just an all-around great guy, which is, I think, where we're going to start, Justin. One thing I admire about you is that The Lifestyle Investor came about from your commitment to be a great family man, the best husband and father that you can be, and your search to fulfill that. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, thanks for the kind words, Jay. And I mean, I can echo them right back that I feel blessed to have you in my life. I have learned a lot from you, and I enjoy our conversation so much. And I just want your audience to know how eager you are as a student to learn and to grow your capacity and your knowledge. So I just think you're such a great example for I mean, really anyone in any community, but especially in the manufacturing space like you are. So I just want to pay you that compliment because I look forward to our time, our calls, our meetups, because it is just a blast and time flies.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure. So in regards to me and, you know, kind of the genesis of the Lifestyle Investor, really what happened was I kind of had a wake-up call where I had a friend kind of, you know, call me out politely and say, hey, you know, I noticed that you're working a lot, you know, is your family getting kind of the leftovers? And I said, you know, what do you mean? I'm doing a great job. I'm showing up. I'm doing family dinners every night. You know, I've got weekends free. I mean, I'm really working hard at it. And then in retrospect, it's like, okay, that is potentially a great start compared to certain places, but what if I want to compare to the best of the best and not just to other people or to the average person? And maybe that's not even average. I don't know, but I had this wake up call when I had someone say, hey, your schedule is a reflection of how you spend your time. And I professed to being a family man, but the problem is my schedule said I was a businessman. And that I would schedule all my business stuff first and then squeeze in family time around it. And that was a huge realization that, wait a minute, I should actually be scheduling my family time and then schedule work around it. What are the trips we want to take? What are the activities we want to do? Where are my non-negotiable date nights with my wife and date nights with my daughter? And where's quality family time for all of us? And just really living a life that is congruent with the values that I have, which is relationships and connection and really loving people well. So that was really the start of it, where I was in my head, I believed that I was being a good family man, and maybe compared to some or many, I was. But my wife brought up the point at one point in time, like, it's not good to compare yourself to other people, because just having done a better job than them doesn't mean you're actually doing a good job at that thing. And that just has really resonated with me. And I've been able to shift to really family oriented first, and then plugging in the holes with business and other things that I do second.
There is still the requirement to put money on the table to ensure that your family has its needs covered. And while that sounds good, I think back when I was a shop owner and saying, if I don't put the hours in the business, then we aren't going to be able to cover our monetary needs. So how, and I think you were in a business where, not manufacturing, but something where you were putting in the hours to do the same. And so you had to create a shift. And that's what you call this lifestyle investor strategy philosophy. And what is that shift? Let's just dive into it. How can you create the time to schedule the things that are most important first and not worry about money?
I think it's a mindset shift first, Jay, because when you really boil it down, how much extra work is getting done by working through like a family dinner? You know, is it long term? Maybe the business does marginally better. Maybe it doesn't do any better. Maybe it does worse because you're always there and not giving other people a chance to step up. That's one thing that's kind of hard to measure. But one thing we know we can measure is that a lack of time really has negative consequences with relationships with family. And so to me, if I'm going to default in some place, I'd rather do a little bit less business to have quality time with my family, because that to me is the priority. And that's going to go way further than the dollars will. I mean, most people in their business are probably making enough to get by, and they're wanting more. Maybe the desire is to work harder, figure it out, build this epic life at all cost today. But I think there's a way to balance it where you're giving the most important relationships you have the time that they deserve and pouring into your business in a way that's going to make it profitable and successful. And if you just shaved 10% of time away from your business and pour it into the relationships that matter most, I'm pretty confident no business is actually going to fall apart because of that. And if it does, maybe there are some steps that need to be taken now, because it sounds like it's on, you know, built on a house of cards. I think giving someone else the opportunity to lead and to run point and to learn how to do things in your absence is only going to better your business, even if there are some growing pains in the transition and in maybe some of the mistakes that happen short term. Long term, though, it's going to pay off because you get more people doing things while you're not there, or doing things in tandem with you when you are there.
Was that the first part of your shift then? You just said, I'm not going to work as many hours, and you started scheduling family first?
Yeah, that was it. So that was the first shift. And what's interesting, Jay, is it really seemed like, in my mind, I was like, okay, I'm sacrificing some business. So it's worth it to me to get less business to invest time with my family. I really thought I was going to sacrifice business. But in the process of this, I said, okay, well, if I'm cutting time, I got to cut the least important time. And that brought me to, what are actually the most important activities I do? What are the things that are the hardest to replicate that actually produce the most revenue and the most profit? So maybe I should focus in on that 20% that does 80% of the sales volume or the profit. And if I can get clear on what that is, and I can shift my time to those activities, then I can really have clarity on what activities I should be outsourcing anyway. Like, what should I not be doing? What am I doing that I shouldn't be doing? What's minimum wage work that I'm doing because I just haven't found someone else to do it? I just haven't thought to delegate it. I just don't have the staff yet, and I could hire someone. And that is a great exercise. So when I did that, I got clear on all the activities I needed to do. I used Pareto's principle, you know, the 80-20 rule, right? And I just dialed into those things. And then I outsourced as much of it as I could, or I hired it out, or I brought in employees, team members to do these other tasks. And I empowered them. They were excited to take more of a leadership role. You know, it's important to kind of—
When you say you empowered them, can you give us some specifics? How did you empower them?
Yeah. So I empowered them basically by, I mean, here'd be a typical situation. Let's say, Jay, you know, we're working together and you're someone that I'm excited about building the business with. I would just say, hey, Jay, I just want you to know, I love working with you. I think you're an incredible guy. I think you do great at the things that you do, but I see more for you. And I'd love to see you grow with our business. And I'd like your permission to help teach you some things and give you more responsibility so you can move up. So that way you're not just here temporarily. You're not just here for a year or 2 years. I'd love to build this thing with you long-term. I'd love for you to play a role in helping to scale just an incredible company, one of the best businesses in our space. And I'd love for you to be able to step into a leadership role. Is that something that you'd be interested in? Very rarely do I have someone say no to that. I mean, that's like a heck yes. Like, I can't believe you think of me that way. That's incredible. And it gives you, I'm asking their permission, you know, to work with them in this capacity. But I mean, 99% of the time, people are overjoyed. They want the responsibility. And so, Jay, the irony is, when I thought I was going to get less business because I was working less hours, my business grew when I focused just on the top 20% of activities and delegated things to other people who didn't even do them as well as I did them, but in time they did. In time they did them better.
You know, that I'll throw out there is, I guess as entrepreneurs, we don't think people do them as well as us, but for me, that was an ego thing I had to let go of. And it's as long as we get to the result, there's different ways to make the magic happen. And I found in the long run, not only did they do it as well as me, or my perception of that, but they were much, much better once you really got them going and wound up. You got the flywheel turning.
Yeah, once you empower them and give them a leadership role, they take ownership and they, you know, put so much passion and energy into it that, and often it's something you don't want to do anyway. So you begrudgingly do stuff while they're joyfully doing stuff. There's a big energy shift there. Yeah. But on top of it, what gave me the confidence and comfort to do it was I recognize, let's say they never got as good as me. Let's say that, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe they did, and it was just my ego saying they weren't as good as me, but let's say literally they were just 60 to 70% as good as me. Mm-hmm. And that's the truth. But what if I put five people in charge of five different projects or five different divisions? Well, now I got five people doing, let's call it 60, 70% of the job I would do in those roles. But you add up those five people, I could have never done all five of those jobs better. So even at a worse efficiency, mm-hmm. having more people on board is creating overall more efficiency, more results. And so that's really what gave me the confidence to say, okay, they may not be as good as me, but I can train them. I can teach them. They don't have the tenure or experience that I have, but that comes with time. And if I empower them the right way, they're going to want to get as good as me. They're going to want to be better than me. And I should mm-hmm. want them to be better than me. I should mm-hmm. train them to be better than me.
How did you, once you had made this shift, then make the shift to the passive income of a lifestyle investor? What is a lifestyle investor?
Jay, a lifestyle investor is someone that is able to live their life based on income generated from assets where it comes passively. They don't have to work for those dollars, and that those dollars cover their lifestyle or their cost of living. So however much it costs someone on a monthly basis, they have passive income from assets they own or investments that they've made that they can use and spend today that more than covers those expenses, or at least covers them at a bare minimum. That is the definition of a lifestyle investor. And the steps that people can take, and remember, I'm like, the reason I know what I know is because I have lived the life of an entrepreneur, of a sole proprietor, of, you know, someone that has really worked hard and put in 18 hour days with consistency over a long period of time with no help. So I've made, and along the way, I've made every mistake you can make. So like, I know what I know today because I used to do the thing that I'm trying to teach people not to do and hopefully cut their learning curve in half. But specifically with profits, most people pour all their profits from their business back into their main business. Mm-hmm. And if your business makes it, well, that's a great idea. But the odds of a business having an exit, going public, being bought out are very slim. On top of that, having a business that even makes it more than a decade is very slim. And even if there's an opportunity at one point where the business is, you know, desirable and someone wants to buy it, that doesn't mean that that same deal is going to exist tomorrow. Like, that opportunity may pass away and never come back again. But the reality is most people put the majority of their eggs into the one basket of their business. And whatever they're not putting there, maybe it's going into a 401k or the stock market. And there's really no, there's no time spent on that, or there's not a whole lot of expertise other than whoever you're trusting to manage those dollars. Hopefully they do a good job, but they're going to charge a high fee to do it.
I have to say I'm guilty. When business was good, like a lot of your listeners here, you made money and you enjoyed life, but recessions hit, manufacturing recessions hit, and it gets tough. And sometimes you don't even have enough really to pay yourself. The ups and downs, because you've put everything in your business. And I think back to it, I just felt like I was a dumb investor. You described exactly where I put my money, the 401k and the stock market. I always seemed to pick the top of the market, and I made money on some, but I lost a lot more money on others. So I was just leery of putting money into the market. I bought some sort of an annuity where I didn't make any money, but the agent sure made money. And I just said, you know what, perhaps this is, if you're listening, this is you. I just said, I trust myself. I'm going to put the money back in the business and just try to grow that as much as possible. but I really wanted to be diversified. I wanted to have, I think the expression is the mailbox income, where the checks just show up every month and you cash them and you go about doing whatever the heck you want to do.
That's right. It's a beautiful place to be. So the reason I think that that's important, you know, some people will say, well, I love what I do, or I love my business. But the reality is most people become a slave to their business. They started a business to get out of the rat race or to have more autonomy or to make more money, to have more freedom, whatever it is. But generally, as people scale their business, they end up working harder. They work more hours. They're the bottleneck to their business. Everything runs through them. And even when they graduate to having a team, there's still a demand on your time. So maybe you got off the, you know, the grade B treadmill of like having a job working for someone, but you jumped on the grade A treadmill. So like you upgraded your treadmill. Now you have a nice Peloton treadmill, you know, it has all the fancy gadgets, but you're working harder. You have more time scarcity, and maybe you can work more to make more, but if your time's not matching it, then that can be a real problem. And so I just think for most people, they don't realize the liability that exists in pouring all of your assets into your business and then whatever's left over into qualified plans, 401ks, putting a lot of hope, not skill, but hope into the market. And if you're going to retire anytime soon, that's even more dangerous because you don't know if it's going to dip right when you want to retire.
Yeah, is the market going to crash right before?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to own your time and you want to own your investments. Don't put that on someone else. Find people that can help you build wealth and create wealth and get those dollars working for you. And here's the reality, Jay. When someone has passive income, mailbox money, cash flow that exceeds their expenses, what ends up happening is they are able to unshackle. They're able to take the golden handcuffs off, whether it's a job or a business that they own, and they can really spend their time doing what they enjoy most. So I find that entrepreneurs, when I help them get to a point that they have passive income, they don't need the business to produce that income. So now they're willing to be a little bit more innovative, creative, try different things. They're willing to shift their time, spend their time differently, spend half the amount of time running the business. They're able to use the gifts they've been given in a way that's in alignment with them and really live their purpose and have passion for the things they do. So it's not necessarily to get people to not have a job, to not work, to not have a business, to have a nice exit. I mean, maybe in due time, that's what someone wants, but that may not be what everyone wants. But if you own your time and you can cover your lifestyle without your time, you divorce your time from income, well, then you really get to pour your time into people you love the most and to the activities you enjoy the most. You can live with purpose and passion at the highest level.
One of the things you mentioned is if you are listening and you are not a shop owner, this still applies to you. You don't have to own a business to employ the techniques that Justin's talking about. And I got so many questions here, Justin. I want to, first of all, if someone's listening and trying to put their arms around it, just take a pause here and say, you have a book out called The Lifestyle Investor, and you have a whole bunch of other resources. If somebody wanted to press pause right now and go online and look and try to get a little more familiar with what we're going to dive into, where can I get the book? What are the other resources?
Sure. Yeah. So my main website is justindonald.com. And so, you know, your audience can find out anything about me there, who I am, what I do, our, you know, online course, our masterclass, our mastermind, the private coaching, just the different programs that we do. But there's also my podcast and my book and my blog and everything else, a lot of free documents and content. But for anyone in your audience that wants a copy of the book, I'm actually happy to give it to them for free. All they have to do is pay for shipping, and they can either go to my main website, or the faster way to do it is go to lifestyleinvestorbook.com. And on that website, you'll get, you know, directed through a way to just pay for shipping, get it. I think there are a few free things that come with it. And then all the proceeds of the book go to charity. So whether someone buys it on Amazon, whether someone buys it, you know, through my website, all proceeds go to charity, specifically Love Justice International, which is this incredible organization that stops human trafficking around the globe, over 17 countries. And it's just really a brilliant group.
Yeah, I think that that's commendable for you to take the proceeds and put it to an organization like that. And I think everyone has organizations that they feel strongly about and they want to help out. So thank you for what you're doing there.
Well, this group's just a pleasure. And I just think that, so for a lot of people, money is survival because most people are very scarcity minded around money. They hold on to it and they grip it so tight, and it's so tight that they're trying to control it and not have anything bad happen to it. And it reminds me of, like, you know, if you're showering and you got this bar of soap and it's, you know, you've been washing with it, it's wet, and you squeeze it as hard as you can, it just pops out. You can't hold on to it. The whole goal to, like, to keep control of it is that you're not squeezing it. You're kind of delicately holding it. Your grip is loose. And so I feel like that's the mindset of money, is like, it is abundant. You know, my parents told me money grows on trees and it's limited, right? It's a limited resource and you've got to scrimp and you got to, you know, pinch pennies. And I grew up that way. And my mindset was that way. And then I learned that the most successful people, they don't do that. They just say, gosh, there's so many ways to make money. It's totally abundant. And if I offer enough value, if I impact enough people, I'm going to have this. And if I, you know, invest in or donate to or support people, organizations, things, movements, that it's going to come back. And you know, maybe it's fivefold, tenfold, maybe it's, you know, just a return of initial capital. But at a certain point in time, the money moves from survival to more of a game. And that's when it gets fun. Like, when you have enough to live your life, then you loosen your grip. Most people will, like, once you have enough and you're not, like, it's hard to keep, like, scrimping and squeezing and trying to control dollars when you have enough. At a certain point, it's like, oh, I can do this. I can loosen up a little bit. And I think once that mindset shift happens where money is not scarce, money is abundant, there's tons of ways to make money, the opportunities are plentiful and endless, I think that's when you get into a space where you really can have some fun with money.
I have to thank you for, I have had a scarcity mindset on money for a long time, and you've helped me shift that to an abundance. You have pointed things out to me, and I have to say, it feels good when you spend the money on people that you love, and even people, I'll say, who you don't necessarily love, but the waiter or waitress who just does such a fantastic job and brightens your day, and you leave them a really good tip. And it's that sort of kindness that is, at least makes me feel good, and I think makes the world a better place. And it comes from changing that mindset to more one of abundance.
Totally. And those dollars, like, I like to think about it this way. They need that money more than I need that money. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, they're never going to spend their money, or the odds are really good, they're never going to spend their money on experiences the way that I would like to, the way you would like to. We've discussed this. I mean, one of the things I love about you is how you take immediate action on the stuff that you learn, or areas of your life where you're like, ooh, I need to shift this. You take massive action. And it's just inspiring. And these experiences, these are lifetime memories. Like, stuff will get old, stuff mm-hmm. will break, stuff will go out of style, but an experience with loved ones that they would never spend their money on their own. They don't have the means. And even if they had the means, they probably would never spend their money that way. Yeah. I mean, that is a true gift when you can offer that.
How do we create this cash flow investing? And is it risky? Is it riskier than putting your money in the stock market?
For people that are uneducated, it's going to feel riskier. To people that understand this world, have made it a point to educate themselves, they're going to learn that private investments, that alternative investments, are by far safer, easier to control and manage, are going to produce returns that likely the stock market is never going to produce, but with just more of like a safety built in. Your eggs aren't all in one basket. I mean, yesterday was a brutal day for the stock market. It was absolutely brutal. It got crushed. Why? No one knows. Right? Like what? One day stuff started going down. Other people are like, oh man, I want to lock in my returns, and they start selling. And then it's just this huge, you know, sell off. And the market, it was ugly, but for what reason? For no reason at all. Like there's no control there versus you buy some real estate. Well, the real estate doesn't care that it was a bad day in the stock market. The real estate has a renter in it. That renter is paying you rent. You have cash flow. And even if that renter moves out, you still have a home that you can re-rent. Maybe you got to put some money in to rehab it and you get another tenant and that tenant pays you. But there's intrinsic value built into a hard asset where it's not going to go to zero. And I mean, with the stock market, you know, during the pandemic, we saw what 30-35% drop, like just overnight. And a lot of people think, oh, well, it's fine. It's back. You know, it's ahead. We're doing well. But what most people don't realize is like you lose 30% of your stock market portfolio, and then you gain it back over the next 6 months. So now you're even. So you have a 0% average rate of return. That actually means you lost money. If you had $100,000 and you lost 30% of it, that's $70,000. But then you make that 30% back, you're only doing 30% on the $70,000, right? So $21,000. So you're at $91,000. You lost $9,000. You have a negative return.
This is so important that you see the statistics quoted by the funds and different people. We had a average 10% return last year. And you just showed that a 0% return will actually would have had a $9,000, 9% loss on a 0% return. And this is where the advisors are always making money, even though I didn't.
Yeah, so the advisors are making money. You've got inflation going on. We've got the highest, I mean, never in history has this much money been printed. If people don't understand what inflation is, like, I just want to make sure it's really clear. I was talking to someone the other day and they're like, oh yeah, you know, inflation just kind of happens over time because of the... No, inflation happens because you print more money. You devalue the dollar. That's where inflation comes from. So, and by the way, the people that are printing the money don't want you to know that. And they try and tell you it's less than it is, that it's normal. It is not normal. We've printed over $10 trillion in the last year and a half with another $3.5 trillion on the docket, right? And if you really study the financial statements of the government, which all this is public, there's $20 trillion that literally disappeared out of thin air. We don't have to get that deep into it, but the reality is the dollar is being devalued. So not only did you have a negative loss, you know, you lost money, your financial planner made money no matter what. Like you lost money, they made money. So misalignment, you know, sometimes there's still taxes owed when you lose money, right? Depending on, you know, how long you held it and did you just buy it? Is it less than 30 days by the time you sell it? I mean, there's all kinds of ways and manipulations that can get you in a lot of trouble. But I think people just don't realize what really happens, that just the financial institutions want your money. They want it now. They want it as frequently as they can get it. They want as much of it as they can get because they're going to make money on it. And that doesn't mean you're going to. And I think it's important to realize that having more control, having more of an education, more control, having smart operators in this space with you, to partner with you, to walk arm in arm, there's magic in that.
You touched upon real estate. And one way to do that is to buy a more than one family unit. Maybe it's a duplex, maybe it's a older home with four apartment units in there. Maybe you live in one and you rent out the other. Great way to get your rent paid for free over time. Maybe you buy a small apartment building. That's a lot of hands-on work. Talk to us about the private funds that are under the radar that are real estate based that minimize the risk and at the same time give you that monthly or quarterly check.
Yeah, Jay, this is a really exciting part of what we do in our community, in the lifestyle investor community. And I'm realizing that most people don't even know that this world exists. They basically think that there's like one option and one option only, or maybe it's like 90% of my, you know, liquid assets go in the stock market, 10% go into angel investing, which is the highest risk stuff. You know, it does not pan out the vast majority of the time. And that, this is where most people, you know, invest their dollars. So they're basically giving a 0% interest loan for an undetermined period of time in a high risk asset that likely won't return.
Right.
But that's what most people do. They're like, ooh, you know, I invested in this company because, you know, whatever reason. That's a story for another day. But inside of the world of real estate, there are private deals, private placement deals, and you can work with sophisticated, experienced operators and partners, sponsors who are real estate professionals. Like, this is what they do for a living. You can do a syndicated deal, which is just them raising money from investors, where you can be a limited partner. You can own a piece of the equity in a deal that is, you know, syndicated or brought together by a bunch of people to invest in, to be able to acquire this asset. So you're truly an owner. You don't own the deed of the property, but you have a percentage of that asset. And then to take it one step further, that could be for like an apartment complex or an industrial warehouse. But to take it further, there are then funds that exist. So instead of investing in one single deal, it invests in multiple deals, and it de-risks that investment, because if something goes wrong with one of them, you've got 10, 20, 30 that things typically go right with. So there are a lot of ways to look at it, but these are your private deals. You've got private real estate deals. You go with a group that has 20, 30 years of experience. They've been through ups and downs before. They've lived through a recession. You find people have had success. I also like to find people that have lost money at some point, so I know that they like get it, that they had to change. They had to, early on, they made some mistakes and had deals go bad, but their track record for the last 15, 20 years is that they haven't lost money. You know, that to me is like an incredible way to invest, because they're going to do better than I would at managing that asset. They're going to buy it with better terms than I would. But more importantly, I just don't have to do anything. Right. I have to vet the deal one time and that's it. And by the way, I might not even know how to vet a deal, but I might know someone who does that invests or that's willing to look at it. Or, you know, maybe I partner with someone and say, hey, help me make sure this is good and I'll, you know, pay you for your time.
I want to really dive into some of these real estate aspects. But one of the things which you taught me and which I've seen is the syndication. So syndication being your part of a group that's buying one property. And correct me if I state this wrong, but they try to buy undervalued. They try to take out a loan for, say, 65% of the property value. And so they're not taking out a loan for all of it. So there's less risk there. But they'll put some money in, they'll fix it up, they'll raise the rents, and they try to increase the value of the property. And with the goal of 2 or 3, 4 years refinancing, because the property's gained in value and now they can refinance and take out the money that all the limited partners, of which you are one, put in, and you will have your principal back, which we're going to talk about your commandments down here, but you've got all your money back in two, three, 4 years. You still own a percentage of the property. And if it ever gets sold, you get the value of that after the loans are paid off. In the meantime, while this has all been going on, you've been getting a return every month or every quarter of 6 to 8 to 10+%. And there's tax advantages, because depending how they describe the return, it could be what they call return of capital, which means that it's not really income because you're just getting your money back that you put into it. as well as there's depreciation, which means you actually may show a loss on your investment, even though you're getting these checks in the mail. So I'm just distilling what you've taught me. Please expand on that and anything I missed.
Jay, that was beautiful. I mean, you just laid it out so well, so neat and clean, and that's exactly it. So not only can there be tax advantages based on the first part of it being a return of principal, which is your initial investment, but there are tax advantages because you get to depreciate the asset. The government basically has tax code that wants to, so basically the government has an agenda of things that they want to do, things that they want to see happen. They want to create more renewable energy, solar, whatever. They want more agriculture. They want affordable housing. So all these things, they're going to incentivize people to do. So they're going to say, hey, if you do these things, if you buy housing, we're going to give you some perks because as a country, we need it. As a state, we need it. As a city or county, we need this. Like, this is good for us. Therefore, we're going to give you tax advantages on it. And there's all kinds of tax advantages that exist. There are tax abatements where you don't even have to pay taxes. You pay a lesser amount. I mean, there's so much cool stuff that you can do with just tax mitigation. So everything you said is spot on. One thing I will point out is the first thing you said is that these operators buy an asset under value. And I would say the goal is that they buy the asset under value. You got to be careful because some groups don't buy them under value and they think they're going to make that return by, you know, just doing what you said, you know, fixing it up and increasing the rents and increasing occupancy, cutting expenses. And some might do that and some might not do that. It depends how good the plan is. It depends how experienced they are. But I think that's where you got to be careful is everyone says they're buying under value or that they got a good deal, but you got to look at the numbers and know whether it's a good deal, because if they buy at an aggressive price, which a lot of groups are doing this right now, they're buying over value because there's a bidding war, there's competition. Well, then the margins are less. And I really like to work with groups that hold true to buying assets under value. And the way you can figure it out is just look at all the comps around it. You know, you can know if they're paying more, paying less. You can look at the cap rate or capitalization rate that they're buying an asset for to figure that out. So everything you said is wonderful. I just want to make sure that your audience knows that not all syndicated deals, not all funds are made the same, that there is definitely an important aspect of having a great operator, having a great sponsor or partner who is running the deal. And once you've got a relationship with them, it's amazing because you can just keep getting in all the deals that they do. So you find a great partner, and then this could be a long-term play. Every deal they do, you could get into.
You're so right, though. The due diligence, that's something you just have years of experience doing. And if you have not made these types of investments, you're not sure of the questions to ask. You get the documents that describe the deal and it's all Greek to you. Get somebody on board who can help you. It might be your attorney. It might be someone who specializes in these. It might be a friend who's done them. It might be Justin Donald and one of his resources. Start with the book. But yes, the goal is to buy undervalued. Real estate is not just one entity. There are so many different flavors. Could you just describe some of the different types of real estate assets out there and maybe ones that you think are overvalued today and ones where there's potentially still undervalued or more likely to be undervalued?
Yeah, that's a great question and really just a great specific inquiry because not all real estate is created equal. So to me, I think the asset class that has the most potential, the most upside, the least amount of risk is probably one that most people from the outside looking in would say is really unsexy, and that's mobile home parks. I love that asset class. I think it's incredible. It's affordable housing. It is recession proof. There's a limited supply of them. There is increasing demand every day that goes on. And so that to me is a great asset class. You've got industrial distribution centers and warehouses. This is another asset class that I really like because the world of e-commerce is just going to continue to grow and expand and get better and bigger, and the demand is going to increase. And so you're going to need places to house inventory and ship, and you're going to need these assets that are inside the last mile to the location it needs to end up at, which is really the secret sauce. That's the greatest expense and the toughest to manage the logistics of. So to me, that's a great place. And I like buying existing assets because not only are they easy to maintain, there's just the lowest amount of anything you got to put in them, of any asset. Like, you can buy a warehouse as is, you know, you don't even have to paint it, sweep the floor and then rent it, because whoever's coming in, like, they want the place to store inventory. If they want to paint it, they can paint it. And they're not worried about the price of rent. That is such a small component. You know, it's the tiniest expense compared to all the other expenses that they have. So I love that asset class. I also love ground up builds, because those generally go to your tier one tenants, your Amazon, FedEx.
What is a ground up build?
So that would just be a development where someone builds a warehouse at today's specs and standards, kind of like a state-of-the-art new development. And these are the ones that, you know, your largest companies in the world want access to and want to rent, and will sign big leases and will guarantee the lease. I mean, even if they move out, they will guarantee the lease. And that's a great place to be. So those two are two of my favorites. I do like single family homes as well, but more at scale than I do individually. So I know a lot of people make money buying these, like doing the short-term rentals. Some people do long-term rentals. Some people do short-term rentals. Both strategies can work. Both strategies are great for the right person, for, you know, if you have the right team in place that can manage it, or if you want to invest your time into managing it properly for a higher return. You know, earlier in my career, I did everything myself because I wanted to make the biggest return I could. And that was a good use of my time. And today, now that I know all these things that I didn't know, I can teach and train people to do it because I value my time more. And I would rather have someone else do those things, even at a lesser return. But at scale, or when someone else has a fund, or, you know, a series of syndications, I like that asset class because that's pretty strong too. I think that there's a place for office, commercial real estate, specifically office. I think there's a place for retail. Both have really gotten crushed. And I think you have to be careful. There's more bad deals than good deals, in my opinion. But there is still a demand for each of those. And right now we're in a season where you could probably find these at a discount. So that's good. From a cash flow standpoint, I'm mentioning a lot of these because I like the cash flow that it produces.
What are typical cash flows? And there's typically two components, the preferred and then the, I'll call it, profit sharing. Would you describe those, that all these types of deals should spin off?
You bet. So with rentals, with real estate where you're renting it out and someone is paying to use that space, there's going to be profit, or there's going to be at least cash flow. There's money coming in. And most investments are going to be set up where there's a split of profits. So some investments might just do a straight split. And if it doesn't cash flow, that's more common that there's a straight split. What I prefer are investments that have a preferred return, which means they pay a certain percentage, maybe it's 6% to 10%. That's pretty standard, somewhere in there. I would even say 5 to 10% is what they're going to pay you first. You get first dibs. All investors get paid that percentage before the general partners make any money on the deal. And then after that's been paid and you have your original principal investment back, then there's a split, and maybe it's a 70-30 split, 70% to the limited partners, 30% to the general partners, or 60-40 or 80-20, whatever it might be. So that's the general structure. And that's, for me, what I like to see. I want to know that as an investor, I'm going to get paid first. And then I also like that their returns are tied to the end result. So they have skin in the game until the very end of the movie. That keeps us in alignment. So I talked about the example earlier where I lose money in the stock market, but my financial planner makes money. That's a misalignment.
Right.
I much prefer a deal where not only do I get paid the first, let's call it 10% of profits. All right. I get the first 10% before they make a cent, but they don't make any of their money until they sell the asset or refinance the asset. That to me feels really good because they have a vested interest to see this go well, and I'm going to make money all the way through it.
Another way that you can be aligned is if they are putting a substantial amount of their own money into the fund, and I get the heebie-jeebies if I see a fund where they're basically not putting any money in at all, that we're not aligned.
Yeah,
and they're taking money out along the way.
Yeah, they've got to have skin in the game. And, you know, generally you want to see them at like 5 to 10%, at least 5% of the deal with their money in. That to me is really important, that I want my money exposed at the same time that theirs is exposed. And mm-hmm. there are other deals that don't cash flow. I mean, there are some really good opportunities with raw land or with land for agriculture. Likely won't cash flow, but maybe you can flip it quickly if you can get it at a low enough price and sell it at a high enough price. That could be a great way to, you know, to get in the game. But I don't like getting into anything that doesn't produce cash flow until I have the cash flow that I want to live my life. So my focus is cash flow first.
This is a great segue. Commandments of Justin, the 10 commandments of the lifestyle investor. We've danced around a bunch of them in our conversation, but maybe you could pick one or two and say what they are and why they're important and give examples how you implement or how you look at them.
Yeah, sure. So my 10 commandments are basically my 10 criteria to investing. I look for certain criteria, and when it checks the box, I feel real good about it. If something checks all 10, I feel great about it. You know, if it checks 9 or 8, I really want to do a little more work. If it only checks 1 or 2 or 3, I mean, it's a no-brainer. It makes it easy for me to pass on a deal and not spend too much time digging into it. And so, you know, my first criteria is lifestyle first. That's the first commandment, because I want to invest in things that are going to amplify my lifestyle, that are going to help my lifestyle appreciate or you know, really just gain better quality. If I can live my life through passive income, it creates a lot of options. And the goal is ultimately that, to create a lot of options. And then beyond that, I think I really want to get kind of comfortable with the risk profile. So Warren Buffett is really big about saying, don't lose money. You know, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one. And so that's my second one. My second commandment is, you know, really to reduce the risk, find ways to ensure that you're not going to lose money. Find ways to ensure that your dollars are going to, you know, maybe you're not hitting a home run. Like, I don't need to hit a home run. All I want are singles and doubles, but to not lose money on any deal.
I just want to touch on that. The media always highlights the people who hit the home run, who hit the grand slams, but the most consistent way to make money in the long run is to consistently hit singles and not lose money.
That's right.
Take less risk. If you're hitting home runs or grand slams, you've got a lot of risk.
Yeah. And every now and again, you can package a deal that has no risk or virtually no risk with an outsized return. But at the end of the day, if I have a solid return, but the profile is set up where I'm not going to lose money, or if I lose money, it's very little, I'm going to take that all day long. Then the deal where I likely would lose a decent amount if it didn't go well, but the upside's really high. A lot of people emotionally want to start cashing checks early. Well, you know, they're projecting this, the pro forma or the spreadsheet that they come up with that shows a best possible scenario of what's going to happen. The most, you know, some call it the most likely scenario, the best, but it's like maxing out the deal, maybe with a little bit of margin for error. that's usually not what happens. Usually it comes in below that and often by a significant margin. So if you're excited about a 20% return, an IRR, an internal rate of return every year that that investment's happening, you really can't just like spend that money before it's there. You don't know what's going to happen until the end of the investment hold.
They're probably not giving you the middle of the road or worst case scenarios when you see the projections. They are giving you the optimum outlook if everything continues to go well.
Yep.
In general, because they're selling you something.
That's right.
Any other commandments, any other principles that you think are important, particularly, let's say I'm a shop owner and I am looking at an exit in the next year and I'll have a pile of money, or I just sold my company 3 months ago, I got a pile of money, but no income now. How do I get started on this? Because treasuries, what, or bank accounts, 0.01%. With inflation, you're losing money by sitting in cash and you won't sleep at night probably if you're in the stock market. What do you do with this big pile of money? How do you get started on the path you've described?
Well, I think that it's important to start learning and understanding the other world of investments that exist. So the first thing I would say is don't race to get all your money placed right away. So you had a windfall of cash, you're sitting on some cash. The goal is not to invest all that as fast as you can or to put all of it into one deal. Like, you actually want to be systematic. You want to learn what you're doing and you want to spread out the risk by investing in a number of different opportunities just in case something goes wrong. And so to me, I think it gets smart. I think it's smart. I think it's really important to find a network of people, a peer group that's doing the thing that you want to do, that's playing the game of life at the level you want to play it at, that's playing the game of business or investing at the level you want to play it at. Find a coach, find a mentor, find people that can partner with you on your journey. So like-minded people, I think, is so important. So before you make an investment, find people that are smarter than you that can help teach you and advise with you, or that are doing deals that you can get in on. I think that would be the place I would start. And then from there, it's all about making that first investment and finding a deal that is
low risk. It's going to be uncomfortable. It was for me. So don't make it a big deal, but make a deal. You've got to get started.
Yeah. And that's the truth. Like, you're going to hold on to your money really tight because you don't want to lose anything. And for most people, it causes inaction, right? Inactivity.
Right.
Like, they can't ever get to the point where they let it go. But once you let it go and you can start seeing some of the positive results, it becomes easier. You're building a different muscle. You're building a muscle where you're learning to allow your capital to produce income rather than your time. And I think that's where the magic happens, you know, and it just starts small. Like, you're probably not going to replace your income overnight. Even if you had a big windfall of cash or a big inheritance, or you sold your business or whatever it is, like, it's probably not going to happen overnight. But what if with your first investment, you can cover your utilities? Or what if you can cover your mortgage? Or what if you can cover your car payments? I mean, it starts somewhere. And then at a certain point, you just keep stacking these deals. You stack this cash flow on top of itself. You know, you get into two deals, then three deals, then five, then 10. And at a period of time, you're like, oh, wow, I now have my minimum cost of living. Maybe it's $50,000 a year or $100,000 a year, whatever it costs you to just survive. Just that in itself is the hugest weight to take off your shoulders, just to know that if everything imploded, if your business imploded, if you lost your job, whatever happened, that you at least have the bare minimum expenses covered. Maybe you don't have your lifestyle yet. Maybe you're not eating out at fun, fancy restaurants, but at least you can put food on the table and cover your bills and your family's going to be fine. Just that moment where that happens, there is a shift mentally and a shift physically that happens, and a shift emotionally, just even spiritually, like, what happens in that moment where you're like, wow, I'm not dependent upon this business, this job, this deal being done, whatever, you know, situation that you need. All of this is extra. And that is a just beautiful place to be.
We have covered so much great material here. I have one last question for you, but before that, is there anything else we didn't cover that I didn't ask you that you want to get out there?
Well, I think that, you know, I say this in my podcast to wrap up each session, because I think it's this important, Jay, and it's that the mission is to take some form of action. Mm-hmm. What step can you take today to move towards a life of financial independence and financial freedom and a life by design that you designed with intentionality, and get out of the rat race, get out of living life on autopilot, get out of putting out problems and just being, you know, someone that responds to stimuli, to scenarios, to situations, to issues, but rather put yourself in the driver's seat of creating the life that you want to live. And it, again, it's not going to happen overnight, but you could take a step tonight. Mm-hmm. Maybe that step is as simple as grabbing coffee with someone you know that has figured a few things out, that at least is one step better than you right now in their investment portfolio, or in owning real estate, or in investing in companies, whatever that looks like. Or maybe they specialize in debt, senior secured debt, you know, which is a safe position to be in. So I think if you can just take a step each day, and they don't have to be big steps, these could be baby steps. So if you just take a step each day towards a life of financial freedom, towards a life by design, you're going to look back a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, and your life is going to be totally transformed. It's going to be night and day.
My recommendation as a first step of action is to go on Amazon and buy Justin's book today. It is a great place to get started. So my final question, Justin, how did you manage to read so many books in 1 year? What was the number?
My original goal was I wanted to get to 100 books. And, you know, I had friends tell me it was literally impossible. You can't do it. And so that was the goal, was 100 books. And I got to 100 books like midway through the year. So I thought that was going to take me a whole year. I got through it midway through the year. So I adjusted to 150 books. And actually, I think what I did was adjusted to 125, and then I upped it to 150. So the final number was 173.
That's insane. So how did you do that? Just real quick, what's that like?
So this took a plan, because this doesn't happen by default. I can assure you of that. And so I mean, generally every day I wake up and I read. I think there are a few days that exist in any year that I don't read. I mean, I could probably count on one or two hands how many days, you know, in 365, I don't read first thing when I wake up. I love to do it. I wake up early. No one else is awake. There are no distractions. And that's what I do. So generally I'll read for an hour. Maybe it's only a half hour. Maybe it's 45 minutes. You know, at some points earlier in my career, when I didn't have as much time, I read 15 minutes before I started anything. And that was it. I didn't have a whole lot of time, but I carved out 15 minutes. What's nice is this world of audiobooks, because if I'm in my car, I don't listen to music. I listen to audiobooks or podcasts. And I'm proud to say, even in that year that I read 173 books, I still listened to a lot of podcasts. So that actually took away from my number, you know. When all said and done, it could have been higher, but I got some podcasts that are favorites and I'm not going to carve them out. But I do spend most of my time listening to books, especially when I'm really into them. And I have certain genres of books that I'll listen to while I work out. So if I have to take notes, I like the physical book in my hand. I like to highlight. If I'm working out and I'm listening to Shoe Dog, the story of Nike, you know, Phil Knight's incredible entrepreneurial journey, that's something I can listen to while I'm working out and just be totally entertained. So I love that. Like, even during the sessions that I do cardio, I just forget I'm doing cardio. I'm in this world listening to these amazing entrepreneurs and all the things that they're able to create in the world. And then generally I read before I go to bed. So that's really how I did it. I carved out time, you know, during that year, I think I read for an hour in the morning. And then once my family wakes up, I always like to hang out and spend time with them. I'd listen to it anytime I was in the car. I would listen to it at the gym. And then I would generally carve out another hour somewhere in the day, sometimes some days 2 hours. And then anytime I traveled where I could get extended time, I'm on a plane I've got a long road trip or some sort of long drive. I mean, I'd just, you know, rip through a book. I would, as often as I could, just try to find that space to be able to do it. But if I could wrap up my day with another 15, 30, 45 minutes of reading, it adds up, Jay. I mean, a couple hours a day, 2.5 hours, even just 1.5 hours a day. That is a tremendous number of books at the end of the year.
Kudos for that practice and for sharing that with us, and maybe inspire some folks here to grab a book or an audio book and get going. Well, this went by so fast. You have so much knowledge and experience, and I appreciate you sharing it with our listeners and how you live your life. You're enjoying it with your family and giving back to your community and the causes that mean so much to you. It is very inspiring. Thank you for letting us become aware of that part of you, Justin.
Well, thank you, Jay, for this opportunity for us to hang out and dive into these topics a little bit more. And I can't think of a better person to be able to share what I've learned over the years, because you're so hungry, you take action, you share this with the people in your world, in your community. And so it's just a pleasure to know you and work with you and do life together with you, Jay. So I just hope everyone in your community knows how special and unique of a human being you are, and the luxury that they have in getting to, you know, get a piece of your mind and learn how you think and learn the skill sets that you've acquired over time as you become an expert in your craft and in your industry.
Thank you, Justin. Very appreciated. Well, listeners, Justin has truly changed my life. He's helped me achieve financial freedom by teaching me how to implement cash flow investment strategies. I am making myself now, on average, over 10% of my money, much of it paid monthly, in what I consider lower risk investment than the stock market. It's been a new skill to learn. It's been fun. And I encourage you, if you want to create income totally separate from your shop income, income that will be there whether business is good or slow, Justin's strategy is a great place to start. And the bonus is that this income gives you the choice on how you spend your time, maybe giving you the freedom and the mindset that it's okay to go to your kid's soccer game in the middle of the workday and maybe even be that coach. Until next time, keep those spindles turning, those lasers cutting, and that cash flow. Have a profitable day.
Thanks for listening to the Job Shop Show podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to subscribe so future episodes are automatically downloaded directly to your device. You can also leave an honest rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Not only do I read every single one, it also helps me understand what content matters most to you. Thanks again for listening to the Job Shop Show.